Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is the 28th of June. And, you know, there are days where you get up and you just have a little skip in your step and you're happy to be alive. And you're just like, man, today's beautiful. It's June. It's another day. I'm going to take it. I take the bull by the horns and I'm going. And then there are other days where you're just like, okay, I'm going to be in the fetal position in the closet.
Yeah.
And today's
yeah.
one of those days.
And today's
one of those
days. And just taking a little census of the room, I see that seems to be the sort of day that that we're in for, at least amongst the panel. I don't know. From the people I've talked to, it seems that it may be a rather universal feeling. But here we go. We're gonna talk about all of this today. We had a major announcement yesterday that we're gonna get to in a moment regarding the Supreme Court, and it was.
I thought you were talking about the Yankees losing.
No,
you're talking about something else.
Oh, you're man. Right. No,
that would be
that
did it.
Yes,
that
would
be
knock somebody's day off.
That's all we had to worry about. Yeah. Remember those days when
the
that was all
time.
You had to worry
David
about.
David Gastina is bragging on how well the Red Sox are playing, and then the Yankees lost.
Oh,
and
well.
That's what this must be. What you're talking
right.
about.
You're trying to redirect.
That's right. Deflection.
Well, first of all, quickly, let me just thank our incredible panel yesterday for on our show on immigration yesterday. Thanks, Vera. You were part of it, and it was very meaningful and very special. I learned a lot, and that started my level of depression, because that was, you know, that's very sobering. It's a sobering topic.
But, you know, it was also a dynamic panel. We got to ask answer a lot of questions. The audience asked some really smart, insightful questions, made observations. It was really good to think about people that need our support, and that is one of those issues we can rally around.
So, and then, good. I hopefully that's how most people felt when they ended, and then by 2 o'clock we shot that to hell. So let me introduce the panel to you, and we'll get into these and all this stuff. Joe Bonilla is with us. He is a communications consultant. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, John. I'm doing okay.
That's just okay. Just okay.
I'm here with wonderful people, so that makes my day a little bit better.
We love Joe Bonilla.
Yes. Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. I love you, Ira.
Well, thank you. This, as you stated, this is not to be confused with the happiest place on earth today.
Right.
Disney
yes.
has it's saved for Disney for another day.
Vera Carias-Kelly is a professor of comparative politics at Siena College and joins us. We get a twofer. This is great. We get you twice in a week.
That's right. And I'm going to turn things around today. I'm going to have some positive things to say. How's
really?
That?
All right.
What are you going to be talking about?
Yeah.
Something, right? You'll figure it out.
I'll figure it out.
Well, please let us know. And in our little beam of sunshine, Alan Chartok, good morning.
Well, so I was on the media project with Ira before. He wouldn't let me get a word in.
Listen to the tape, as they say.
No, actually.
Roll back the
actually,
audio tape.
I brought everything I had to that program,
yes,
so I'll have much less to say on this one.
All right. We'll see.
Let's put it to you this way. At the mid part of the program, when I reminded people what they were listening to.
Oh, that's right. You're hosting this one.
Yes,
yeah.
I introduced Alan twice because he was talking twice as much as he
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. It is a thrill and a privilege to have you all in our studio with us. You know, I don't know if we say this enough of just how lucky and how wonderful it is that we have the panel that we do and the people that come in and do this for us. And we are very appreciative. So
and that we have you, and that we have you, Joe. To
well, and that we have you, Alan, to bring it all together. But we do appreciate it and we thank you. So all right, now to the. Now to the crappy news. Okay, so Justice Kennedy announced yesterday that he was going to retire. I will say that on what's today, Thursday. So on Tuesday, I know when the decision came out in regards to the upholding of the Trump travel ban, many commentators, probably the most the loudest in that group was Jeffrey Toobin on CNN of saying that this was an given what Kennedy said in that decision in one page and taking and while supporting the uphold of the travel ban that taking the president to task was a clear sign that Kennedy had no intention of leaving his seat on the bench. Well, that obviously didn't happen, and 24 hours later, Justice Kennedy announced that he would be retiring at the end of July.
Do you think Dubin may be holding his head right now and saying, you know, since I said that, it may well be that what happened here is he heard that, he got so angry, he went out and he retired.
Well, that would be giving Jeffrey Toobin a bit too much influence.
Just a tad.
So, okay, but let's ask the question, though, because I think it's obviously worth asking, which is, if you are Justice Kennedy and you know the cards on the table, and you obviously through your own words and in what you have written about decisions, you have grave concerns about the actions of this president. What then motivates you? Do you take him at his word that he wants to spend more time with his grandchildren?
That's funny.
Well, I'm asking. So, I mean, if you know what is at stake, what is the motivation to do it?
Well, he's an old guy. He's just an old guy, right?
Yeah, I don't begrudge the man.
Well, aren't they all
retirement.
Old guys? I mean,
yes, they are, and that's one of the things that's so dangerous about this whole thing, because this isn't where it stops. And here's Trump up there last night bragging, braggadocio, beating his breast, and saying, you know, that, you know, I'm going to affect this court for the next 40 years. And he's not kidding.
No. And what you look at him right now, he'll get at least two appointments. And you look at, you know, consequential presidents, you look at Reagan had four. You look at Eisenhower, he had five. So the chance.
You look at Obama, and he had.
Obama had two. And he could have had the three if Merrick Garland actually got confirmed.
Nixon had four.
Nixon had four as well. But the real, you know, critical thing is that this is more than just, you know, beyond the presidency or two. This is, we're talking about 30 to 40 years of actual change. And then beyond that, the impact of what the court will actually put through. But it's not surprising to me that Kennedy would definitely retire at this point. It's a little bit surprising he would do it before the midterms. But, you know, given that he was appointed by Reagan in 86, he was on the Ninth Circuit in California before that. He's still a diehard California Republican, for what that's worth.
And a conservative.
Right. So for him, I do take him at his word that he may have wanted to spend more time with his family, but that remains to be seen if we see comments, you know, beyond his retirement.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I don't begrudge the man his retirement. We don't know whether there's anything beyond it. These guys, it must be an incredible burden on these people. And I just, you know, he put in what, how many years on the bench? 30 to 40 years.
32.
The issue is, it's not so much now why did he retire, but what's going to happen going forward. And it's very hard if you believe, as most moderates and progressives do, that this is a disaster for the court. It's very hard to find any optimism or anything to dissuade you otherwise, because the Democrats can say they're going to fight and they're going to do this, and hopefully some of the Republicans are going to not march with the rest of the Republicans. The odds are just infinitesimal against it, and I just, at that point, that's why we are all looking with our chins on the ground, because I'm not sure what the next sentence is, particularly when you bear in mind that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 85 and Stephen Breyer is 80.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm expecting President Trump to start nominating people very soon, within the week. He has his list ready from last time around. He will probably pick somebody, that's the expectation, he will pick somebody who will be so right that it is almost, inconceivable to many of us in this room. And, when we think about who will be the swing vote, when you think about, the Chief Justice becoming the swing vote, we know where this is going. So,
although he didn't let down, I'm going to say us advisedly, but he didn't let us down on the health care decision when he was the swing vote.
So he's got it in him. Swing vote.
Well, that was fascinating, and we could talk about that for the next 5 hours. What he did there, it's clear he bashed Obama, and he bashed the law, but he knew that he had to uphold it because of what was at stake there. Yeah. That's Roberts.
And so Roberts may be in that position. Well, when we think about, where we're at now, the swing vote hasn't really been that evident before, except on social issues in the past.
Right.
So I think we have to ready ourselves for quite a conservative Supreme Court, and as soon as one of the other justices goes, it'll be a 7-2 vote in the near future. 6-4, 6-3 is the expected outcome in the coming years, I would
think. Well, look, before you give it away, and I think you're right to say that the chances are that he will get this choice. And you'll have to be very clear about who he nominates. He's going to nominate an outstanding conservative. He is not going to go, there's a big talk now. Trump Jr. talked this morning about Jeanine Pirro. Her picture was up there with the six leading contenders this morning. And if you think about Donald Trump and who he is, it's not something that he would not do. However, I think he's going to have to find somebody. But here's what. You have Susan Collins. Do you really think Susan Collins is going to let a court exist in which, women are going to lose the right to have an abortion? Do you really think that she's going to vote that way? Or Jeff Flake, who's so angry at the president? And McCain, as you know, is out. So it may happen that there will be some real resistance.
Yeah, what about the Democrats who are likely to go the other way? Joe Manchin is one.
Heidi Heitkamp.
So I don't. There might be. This may not be even an issue because of.
Well, if those
the
Democrats,
fear of the Democrats in those conservative states. Yeah.
Well, if those Democrats go that way, there is a particular place in hell for them.
Well, get ready.
Well, it's also, let's see. This is really the bigger test for Chuck Schumer as well. Can he actually rally folks to actually stay the party line and vote against, whoever the president actually nominates?
Well, if you saw Joe, his analysis yesterday or his pushback, it was pathetic. I mean, you need a guy out there who was calling the troops, who was saying, now's the time to resist.
I agree with you, Alan, because in watching him yesterday, the argument that he had was, okay, well, you held up our nominee saying that it's only fair to wait for the election, so we say it's only fair to wait for the election. Okay, but we all know that's not going to happen. So beyond that, what's your argument?
Well,
and he didn't seem to have the argument.
No, it wasn't that he was wrong about what he was saying. It was the passion.
That's right.
Have passion about something that's never going to materialize. I mean, this is like how can you? What you have to have is a real plan. And plus, there are some other electoral outcomes in the primaries that force the Democrats to have a very serious family conversation here, because they need to figure this out.
I agree with Alan about Schumer's performance yesterday. That said, this is the U.S. Senate, and even Mitch McConnell is not somebody who sets the world on fire when he speaks. When he stole the seat from Obama, the appointment of Merrick Garland, it was a very calming, very turtle-like speech, nothing spectacular about it. Schumer's was the same. If it was Dick Durbin, who I actually have always thought would be a better minority leader than Schumer, he would have been the same. That's just part of the decorum of the Senate. Where I'm particularly disappointed with Schumer, however, is the kind of the lack of passion that he exhibits when he's not on the Senate floor. I don't sense this is the guy that you want to follow. He spends, every Sunday having a press conference about the most obscure things that are consumer related. I guess it's not to say that they're unimportant, but I would say they're unimportant for the minority leader of the U.S. Senate.
Well, I've always liked Chuck Schumer. I've spent some real time with him, and, I think he's a man with his head on straight. However, I am deeply disappointed in him now. I really am.
But again, the question is, who else in the party, who else in the Senate can be that rallying voice?
Well, Bernie's out there this morning, I can tell you that much.
Bernie's not a Democrat.
Well, yes and no. Come on, Ira.
I'll tell you who they need. It'd be very difficult to get him right now, but Ted Kennedy.
A little difficult. Yeah.
Well, there was a problem with that, Ira. He's dead.
Yes, that's why I say it would have been very difficult to get him.
But, I also think with the family conversation that I made a reference to, we need to think about a new generation emerging in the Democratic Party if we want to get ready for the struggles that are about to emerge and are emerging. I think, you know, the party machine is taking some hits and we can't continue on the same path. New ideas need to be integrated, and that is what this family conversation has to be about.
Well, you know, the Republicans did that about 10 years ago. They had this Young Guns program. You had Eric Cantor. You had Kevin McCarthy. So they did that, and then they went into leadership. The Democrats have not done that. When you have the three top House leaders are in their upper 70s, that's a problem when you had, you know, especially after the results we've had this week in primaries across the country. There's a resounding message out there that people want change within the party, but the party needs to respond in a better way.
Well, that makes this election, the stakes for this election are even higher than they were before. Even if the Republican nominee, the Trump nominee, is approved before the midterms, because as I said, there are at least two more who are on the cusp. The Democratic Party has to regain control of the Congress, if not the Senate, and then moving forward, there is, you know, at least they have held the line. Albeit a line that is too far over for most of our liking.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. The Roundtable panel and your letters next, right after this.
Shame, shame, shame on you. I bet you think you're a big man now, but you don't know how to be a good man too.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Letting the music play just a little bit. It's Lake Street Dive. They'll be on Live From Here with Chris Thiele in the shed at Tanglewood this Thursday, June 30th, tanglewood.org. Saturday, June 30th, Live From Here is Chris Thiele's show. By the way, he did a wonderful, Sarah did a wonderful interview with Chris Thiele on Tuesday's broadcast. If you get a chance to listen to it, it's really terrific.
And you go to WIC.org and
that's
do it
right,
that way?
Slash Roundtable. And you can also find the playlist there, which tells you the music that we're playing this morning from Lake Street Dive. So there you go. Good stuff. Now, let's get back to our discussion, and we'll talk about our letters. Let's go to letters.
Denise says, Justice Kennedy, despite some of his swing votes, is a true conservative. He may not be a fan of Trump, but he is probably comfortable with the prospect of another conservative on the bench. It is a sad time in our history, for sure, and that's Denise from Loudonville. I agree
and
with
Denise
that.
And Denise is right.
Absolutely right.
Pete says, thanks for the WMC community for these frightening times. Thanks so much to the panel and the supporting WMC community for taking, I'm so sorry, I mispronounced that, for talking about these almost daily crises coming from the Trump administration. Even in my rising anxiety and great alarm, I feel grounded in knowing I am not alone. United we stand. Do you think that there is any possibility that the mind-body connection happens here? I know somebody whose face breaks out because of Trump, she thinks, in blotches.
Well, and, I mean, stress
and
can have all kinds of effects.
Stress, anxiety,
you know?
Everything together.
I talked
together.
To somebody this morning, somebody Ira knows, who has, you know, some kind of, what is that, Ira?
That's shingles, right shingles. After the election.
You know, I mean, we're talking about, let me just bring something up from yesterday, you know, in terms of anxiety and trauma and stress. People have, you know, those children that are separated from their parents on the border, they will have, there's high likelihood they will have heart disease, obesity problems, drug abuse in their teens, 20s, and 30s because of the high stress hormones that are flooding the body. So when we're talking about people breaking out or having these anxiety issues related to Trump on a daily basis, this is not made up. There's a lot.
But that's the tip of the iceberg.
Yes.
Especially for folks who are experiencing these issues on the border.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so Mike says, morning panel, with the news of Kennedy's retirement, what do you think are the chances of John Roberts becoming the next swing vote? We already talked about that.
Yeah,
you did.
I mean,
absolutely.
Is he our best hope of one of these conservative justices becoming the next David Souter? Thanks, Scared in Saratoga. Well, Mike, I wish I could offer you some hope, I cannot.
I don't think Roberts didn't go all the way to what Souter was. And, you know, you look at with even Kennedy, Kennedy really had replaced O'Connor as the swing vote.
Right.
So we'll see.
And then we heard from Carol, who says, "Hi, panelists. Good morning. On the other hand, with the loading up of the court with staunch conservatives, how will they view Trump's courting of horrible dictators? And how might that play out? Thanks to all." You know, that's a very interesting point. If, in fact, it turns out that there is a terrible scandal, it's terrible, so much so that the court can't ignore it.
Yeah.
Do they still drink the Kool-Aid?
John Meacham, the historian and a journalist, was on this morning on one of the programs and pointed out that Nixon appointed four judges to the Supreme Court, but in 1974, the Supreme Court went against Nixon and the White House tapes were released, and that was the final straw leading to his impeachment. So you have to hope people have integrity.
Well, that's a good point. You can hope all you want. Mm. I don't think these characters are the same as were on the Supreme Court at the time.
So Carol's point about Trump's courting of horrible dictators, so we did find out this morning that the president will be meeting with Vladimir Putin on July 16th in Helsinki. The two leaders will have a sit-down, and the president's comment this morning was maybe something positive will come out of it.
Okay.
Oh boy.
We'll see.
Well,
because
we're
still watching for North Korea, waiting to see what positive things will come out of that.
Well, it is extraordinary, don't you think, Vera? That here's a president who is surrounded by a Mueller investigation, going into all of the relationships with Russia, comes on to be president of the United States and announces how enamored he is of Putin. Goes on and on, even while his sub-lieutenants are saying something different than he is. And now he's going to meet with Putin. Somebody's eyebrows should be raised, don't you think?
He continues to cite Russia's denials as far as meddling in the election is concerned, despite the fact that virtually everyone, including members of his own administration, believe that Russia meddled in the election.
Right, you are, Ira. And Rocco, who checks in almost every day.
Rocco said, from Rosendale?
Yeah, Rocco.
Used to write to the Daily Freeman all the time.
Yeah.
Supreme Court appointment. "I will go further than Senator Schumer's proposal that there should be no Supreme Court hearings until after the elections. A president who is under investigation for high crimes and misdemeanors should not be granted the privilege of appointing such a high office as Supreme Court justice until said president is cleared of all allegations. Otherwise, there could be a coup whereby justices are threatened, then resigned, and are replaced by traitorous individuals with no loyalty to the law, only loyalty to the leader who put them in office." Vera, you're a student of comparative politics. I hear what Rocco is saying, but...
Well, I mean, it sounds really good, but we do have laws that we need to follow. So, I mean, the president does have a right to appoint,
So at what point do you think that we, as you just said, we have laws that we should continue to follow? But at what point do you think it is appropriate to have what we might call civil disobedience?
Well,
in a country
I think it's time to have civil disobedience.
Yeah, but I mean,
which
crosses over the line, you know?
No. It's civil disobedience doesn't mean using any, I mean, I'm not in favor of violence, but people have the right to protest. They have the right to question their representatives. They have the right to organize. There are all kinds of things that can be done.
It's the balance to make their voice heard.
Yeah.
So when you kick somebody out of a restaurant or you do all of that, is that within the bounds of civil disobedience?
Well, it wasn't. Okay, so I wanted to say it wasn't just that the proprietor of a restaurant decided on by herself to kick Sanders out of the restaurant with her group. She was called by her staff. Her staff was, I believe, from what I recall, there were several openly gay or members of the LGBTQ community, and they said they felt profoundly uncomfortable with her being in the restaurant. They called the owner. The owner came. She had a discussion with her staff, and the staff asked her to request that Sanders leave.
But is this what we want? This is Sarah Sanders was kicked out of this restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Across the street, Bernie Sanders might get kicked out of another restaurant.
That's the problem.
This is a slippery slope. I mean, this all smells like the lunch counters in the civil rights movement.
Well, and also, you know? I mean, so if those same restaurant employees were told that that a baker wouldn't bake a cake for their wedding, I mean, that goes to the Supreme Court.
Right.
I mean, so where does that...
So, I mean, the question is, why is a cake a piece of art, and the food made by a farm-to-table restaurant that is lovingly grown and plated in a particular way, not art? I'm just asking where the... I mean, this is a very interesting question.
I'm taking a different side than Ira for a change. I truly think it's all justified, to be honest with you. I think we are in such a dangerous place in this so-called
democracy. So if you walked into a restaurant and they said, Alan, I heard your 745 commentator. I disagree with you. I think you're an important human being. Get out.
And when I posed that question on the media project, you said?
It's happened.
It's happened.
But the question is it right, though? That's the issue.
I know a restaurant in which my picture confronting a bunch of louts in Great Barrington who had big signs against me was up on the counter, and one day it disappeared, and I said to the proprietress of that institution, I said, "Where's my picture?" They said, "Oh, we have somebody in the restaurant, you know, who doesn't like you, who doesn't agree with you." So I took it down. You know, I mean, there's always the chance that that is going to happen to
you. Okay, but that's serving. I mean, it's serving another individual, going into an establishment and being refused service.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because you're a member of an administration. You're doing your job. Mm-hmm. I'm not.
That is trying to kill people. That is trying to.
But, yeah, I mean,
But why is that? Why is that the proprietor of that restaurant and the staff's responsibility to make that determination?
So my question is.
Because they feel strongly.
Okay, so if,
but what if they felt strongly
I am not represented by an administration,
if
I belong to a group that feels deeply wronged, do I not have a right to say, I don't want to prepare the food for that person? I just refuse to prepare the food for that person because that person doesn't represent me. That person actually harms my group. That person does not speak on my behalf.
That person won't let my daughter have an abortion.
Let's extend this because you just said something about it because it's against the law.
Right.
If this, let's say for the sake of argument that Sarah Sanders sued this restaurant.
For what?
For discrimination.
And she could.
And she might. And well, she won't, but could.
Yeah.
And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court.
I don't get it.
What class?
Because you discriminated me for my political views and the job that I hold.
Well,
and
that is not a protected class, as far as I can tell.
Okay, so now
threatened because of whatever reason.
So now that lawsuit winds up in the Supreme Court.
Oh, come on.
Just like the baker's lawsuit.
So, it's what happens.
So, and now we're back to where Joe started.
So now the baker, if you claim a piece of art, you have the right to deny your customer, if your customer is gay, you can deny the wedding cake, but you can't deny... I mean, this would make no sense.
I understand the argument, but I do think I agree with how we started this conversation. With it is a slippery slope, and I also don't know that it helps the cause of the left in doing this kind of thing.
I think we have to do everything in our power to put a stop to this guy.
Well, I would
says get out of here and beat him up or do all of that. Very reminiscent of Hitler early in the day. I think the time for being nicey-nicey is gone. Now is the time that everybody has to make a statement.
I don't think serving a woman and her husband a dinner is being nicey-nicey. I think that's just, by the way, their money is as good as anybody else's.
We have to look to really improve our ideals about where we want to be as a society in this country. You know, we start, you know, picking and choosing about who we're going to serve in restaurants or wherever it could be. That's where we start getting into the weeds, and that's really not speaking to our better angels here.
Oh, I don't know. Who was the famous singer who walked up to Lyndon Johnson or to one of those guys at a reception and told him off right then and there? and it was regarded as being...
Well, that's different.
Well, everything is different, Joe. Everything is different, but this is a time to fight, to mobilize, well, to say we're not going to put up with this.
So I want to use not the word fight necessarily, because people might interpret that as a use of violence, but what I'm agreeing with is speaking up and standing for your convictions, standing up for your convictions.
So that's different if the proprietor of the restaurant mm-hmm. said to her, we take this opportunity, you're in our house, this is where we work.
Exactly.
This is what upsets us. Mm-hmm. That is different than then saying, I'm sorry, you have to leave.
But here's the problem. Everything is different. I remember once, you'll remember that, Joe, fairly well, when I went in and I saw some guy yelling at one of our interns over at the Linda, because who was going to come over that day and give a talk? Somebody. And we were going to take the remarks on the cards as opposed mm-hmm. to, and he says, I don't care. And he started to use profanity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came up and said, you can't say that here. This is my house, I said.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy took a cup of hot coffee and threw it in my face.
Oh.
Now, there are limits, obviously. Wanted to know if he was going to be arrested. Of course, I wasn't going to have him arrested.
But you could have.
Yeah, well, that's bad.
We have
that's
to decide
bad.
As a country where we are and what we want to be. This country is spinning out of control. There are any number of reasons. It didn't just start with Trump, but I think mm-hmm. he really has put his foot on the accelerator.
Yep.
Is this the kind of nation that we want to live in, where if I write a column in my former newspaper that I would be afraid to go to the delicatessen because I can't get a sandwich?
So here's my comment to that. We are living in a nation like that.
That's right.
It's already, we are in it. And I'm opposed to the idea that just because you're in the center or you're politically left, you must be well behaved, whereas the right can act out, because that is a path of no return and we will be silenced. And I refuse to be silenced. I will never use violence. I will never use physical force. I will never use anything that is against the law. But I will speak up.
Nice.
And I will resist. And I will stand up for what I believe in. And I think it is about time we begin doing that.
But I think it's important, though, to still keep that escalation. But at what point do we get to a plateau of de-escalating to not get to a point of violence or any sort of additional activity? That's the issue there. You know, basically, we can still have a balancing of, you know, the left and the right, and still make, you know, our voices heard in a much more meaningful fashion. But we have to have respect for at least both sides.
So maybe I'm really dense here, but so you are saying, Vera, that you agree with the decision for the proprietor to send Sarah Huckabee Sanders packing.
So I think what happened was that the proprietor went and talked to Sarah Sanders. They stepped outside. They had a conversation.
Yep.
And I don't know that it's actually true that the proprietor said to Sarah Sanders, pack your bags right now.
Sort of a mutual decision.
I think it was a mutual decision.
Yeah.
And I think the proprietor basically explained to Sarah Sanders that her staff feels terribly uncomfortable with her being at the restaurant with her staff. And if I'm correct in my memory, Stephen Miller was part of this group.
It's a different group.
Different group?
Different
group.
He
was in a Mexican
restaurant. As was Nielsen in the Mexican restaurant.
Okay,
but
okay,
that was
so
customers who...
That was customers who booed. That was different.
Right.
But, you know, if the proprietors basically explains to Sarah Sanders that the staff feels really uncomfortable, and Sarah Sanders basically said, I agree to go, and the proprietor decided to pay for the cheese plate, and it wasn't as hostile as it's been made out to be. I think it was more or less a mutual decision.
So what? But it's still a matter of degree. You know, I'm thinking of Michelle Obama, which is always being thrown on my mm-hmm. in my face, that when they go low, we go, you know, we higher. I think the other way to look at that is, yeah, that's fine. But when they go low, you don't shut up.
That's correct. We can't. I mean, going higher and higher has not served us a whole lot. We have been ridiculed, shamed, embarrassed, all kinds of things. It's time to speak up and say, no, we're not playing that game.
Couldn't agree with you more, but that's still different than the being asked to leave the restaurant. By the way, someone suggested that what the proprietor should have done was that after Sarah Sanders placed her order, she should have said, "I'll have to get back to you on that," and then never get back to her.
What a terrible All Yelp right. review.
Yes, that's right. And on that note, we are hopelessly late for a break, but that's good. Yeah. That was an interesting conversation. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. We had that whole discussion about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and we never got to the core of it, which was now she has Secret Service protection from the Red Hen. So I don't know. Is that needed?
All farm-to-table restaurants, she will not be able to eat there unless she has...
Has anyone read about this in the sense of, do we know if other press secretaries have had the luxury of a secret service?
As I always do, pop culture?
Please do, Ira. That's why I love you.
In the West Wing, there was a couple of episodes where CJ, the press secretary,
Allison Janney,
got Secret Service protection, much to her dismay, because she had been threatened. And then the kicker to the episode is they caught the guy who was stalking her, and then the Secret Service agent was killed.
But that's stalking.
Yes.
Was she threatened by being asked to leave the restaurant?
No. That was strictly a stalker. Oh.
All right. We have 4 minutes, and we'll do some letters, and then we'll move on.
Okay. We're going to do that. All right. Good morning, panel. For once, I disagree with Alan. Woo. Serve her like anyone else. Just make sure she never wants to come back, and don't take a tip. Not serving sounds like days gone by to me. When we go low, we say no. When they go low, we say no over and over again while we serve. And that's from our friend Eric, who is almost always right, but not this time. Good morning, panel. Although it pains me to say, as I often disagree with Alan, he's 100% right about this. You see the same beginnings as with Nazi Germany. You can't wait till they're marching Muslims and Mexicans into ovens. Now's the time to say no. Say it loudly. Say it all the time. Say it to anyone who's complicit in this administration. The time for civility is over, says Aaron. And Denise says, after the distressing news of Kennedy's resignation, what we have to do is double and triple efforts to register voters and to show up to vote. Follow the example of black voters, especially black women. We show up, and that's Denise and Saugerties.
Good point.
And Elizabeth says, Roberts is concerned with maintaining respect for the court's authority while moving it as far to the right as possible. His Obamacare vote was taken in that spirit, nominally bowing to the public decision while carefully undermining the long-term viability of the program by denying the critical Medicaid expansion. Okay, and it goes on, but that's as much as we're going to read for now. And Paul says, no swing in Kennedy's vote. Mm. So maddening to hear every major media source repeating the narrative that Anthony Kennedy is the swing vote in the Supreme Court. There's rarely ever any swing in his votes, siding squarely with conservative positions 5-4 in almost all the decisions. Right. And yes, after giving away the last open seat to Gorsuch last year, the Democrats' leadership will blow this one as well. There's no functioning opposition party in our country right now. Paul from Altamont.
Kennedy did support gay marriage.
No, on the social issues, he's okay.
Yeah. Right.
But on the bread and butter, economic issues and the other, he's terrible. Okay, and SCOTUS, says Chuck. In 2016, it became apparent that many folks early on that election was not going to be about the presidency, but about the Supreme Court. But it didn't take much far-sightedness, I agree with you so much, Chuck, here, to see that stubborn loyalty to Bernie and not the front runner was not well thought through strategy, and now we will have to live in a strange and unknown country for generations to come. I weep not for myself, but my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Well, I'll be honest with you, Chuck. I thought you were going in a good place, but I thought you didn't end up there. It really isn't about Bernie or about Hillary. It's really about, didn't anybody listen when everybody was talking about what this was going to mean to the Supreme Court?
Well, and then the other thing, too, I think we have not even touched upon, is that, Kennedy's retiring at the end of the term, where when Scalia passed away, he passed away in February. So right now, there's nothing's going to happen in the summer until the Supreme Court term begins in the fall.
And so, Michael says, you never know how many presidents have nominated judges who they thought would carry out their conservative agenda, only to find they did the exact opposite. You never know. All is not lost, Michael. Yeah. I think, Michael, these are not the old days. These are not the old days. These are days when they vet these people so well.
There's already a list.
And they
of
call them in
really
and they get promises and they get handshakes and the rest of it. Yeah. Brucey says, Alaskans and Mainers, the people in Alaska and Maine can call Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins until the phone lines glow red hot. Given their pro-choice stance, this is useful. The rest of us have an election to work out, and that's from Brucey.
But at the same side, you know, people should be calling Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp and other Democrats, make sure they stay the party line.
Sure.
Exactly.
And
except that Joe Manchin is in a red state, and he is not going to get reelected if he does not vote for this.
And Iris, so what?
Well, that's a broader question. You're looking for people who have profiles integrity and who see a greater good. I'm not sure there's a lot of those people out there in Washington.
All right. Let's pause there. When we come back, we'll continue with the letters. Ray Graff with news is next.
If you want my advice, I think it would be wrong for you to get home.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Vera Akarios-Kelly, the hilariously funny Ira Fussfeld, and Joe Bonilla, all with us this morning. And we thank you very much for being here. Now, we have, we got a lot of letters.
A ton of letters.
Yeah. So let's go to those.
That's what we want.
Okay. And Michael says, hi, panel. Isn't Trump's game to have us go to war with one another? Isn't that how he achieves every one of his goals? Isn't that how he thrives and the very definitive definition of dissolution and the quickest route to unchecked power? So isn't it our job and our vested collective interest not to succumb to this civil war? Okay, and by the time, Michael, they have taken all your rights away done all of that, you'll have been on the right side.
Let's all be well-behaved and just hope for the best, I guess.
Did you see as part of that rally last night, Trump was taking credit for the timing of Kennedy's retirement because Kennedy entrusted Trump
on
the replacement. That's always about Trump.
And that's always his narrative.
And Ken says about kicking fascists out of restaurants. I'm appalled by this discussion. Alan is right, objectively right. There is no valid argument on the other side. To bring up lunch counters is Orwellian. The guy who made that point should be absolutely ashamed of himself. If conservatives want to kick Bernie out of restaurants, they can do that. These are private citizens' politics and is not and can never be a protected class. It is so basically absurd to the very idea of democracy that to entertain this argument on your program is repugnant. Oh, come on, Ken, cut it out. That's what we do. We talk. Look, there are two sides to all of this. We talk about
that. Well, and besides, as John McLaughlin would say, wrong.
Richard says, throwing customers out.
He's dead, too.
Oh, he wouldn't say that.
He died?
Yeah.
You could say it. Richard says, throwing customers out. Whatever happened to, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. We know what happened to that. It's unconstitutional.
Really? Except when you make cakes.
Well, and also, obviously,
no
shirt, no shoes, no service, the whole thing, too. That.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Brenda says, resistance. I'm not sure what resistance is going to work at this time. With the Supreme Court and gerrymandering decisions, there does not appear to be a way forward to make a difference. Brenda.
Well, it starts with the midterms. It's too late to save the Supreme Court for now, but you need to vote and you need to get out. I mean, it's been said that this was a great thing for the right, not only because they're going to get their justice, but that they are now going to be motivated turn out in a way that perhaps they weren't. Everybody is expecting the blue wave. This may spark the red wave.
Or a blue wave. We don't know.
And the best thing that could happen is if there were plenty of voters on both sides instead of 23%
but
deciding.
There were also some interesting movements within sort of evangelical communities that were beginning to be quite critical of President Trump for his separation along the border of children from their parents along the border. So there was some movement within churches that said, well, that's immoral. We can't be doing that. We can't be harming children. But now that they have the opportunity to get there, the abortion issue overrides other concerns again. So I feel like the very conservative church communities have now been overtaken once again by the Supreme Court issue.
Let me just ask a question that I heard over and over and over and over and over and over and over again yesterday on the cable news programs, the radio programs I was listening to, in regards to the premise being Republicans are much, much, much better about keeping the eyes on the prize when it comes to voting and securing the Supreme Court, where Democrats are not. And that they are, that the Republicans, they say, many have said that it's in their DNA to secure those seats so they have the power to control the court, and the Democrats do not have that.
Well, we know to some degree, Joe, that's right. We know that there was a concerted effort to take state legislatures who do the gerrymandering and to make sure that the Republicans would win in those places. But also, there's a fundamental difference in who Republicans and Democrats are. Republicans are often, and there's nothing wrong with it, it's just the way it is. Republicans often are those who have a little bit more than the people on the other side. Now, not every Republican, obviously, but if you take a look at the demographics of the Republican Party, Republicans tend to vote to protect what they have, the franchise. Democrats, which I've never quite understood, do not vote in the same numbers, because if they did, there would be no more Republicans in this country. They just don't do it. And it is, to me, perplexing. One of the reasons I'd like to see Deval Patrick as the presidential nominee is because I think when Barack Obama was, a lot of people of color and other people turned out to vote, and they hadn't otherwise, and they did this that time. So I'd like to see that replicated. But how you get people off their keisters to go vote so that their kids can eat in a school, so that there's money for health care, so that all of the things that are most important to them, it's totally perplexing.
When
to them.
They feel in the pocket, and when you have these kitchen table issues that will then get to the forefront of what we're talking about, that's when you really start to see change. And we saw that in 2006. We started seeing that in 2008. And Democrats need to reinforce that message if they're going to actually make a difference this fall.
Okay. And it did work in the New York primary against, what was his name?
Joe Crowley.
Joe Crowley, yeah.
We haven't talked about it.
Yep.
But it, because we were off to do something else yesterday.
Yep.
But it is fascinating, just fascinating. Mm-hmm. You got Andrew Cuomo, one of my favorite subjects, now saying, well, that had nothing to do with me, but it may have. In other words, remember that the last poll that Crowley had showed him winning by 35%, and then he lost by this overwhelming majority because somebody went out with no money, virtually no money, made a connection. And if that is something that, and we know that Cuomo was nervous, we know that, so this could have tremendous implications in the country. On the other hand, leftist candidates may get nominated and then lose in competitive purple districts.
But at the same time, when you saw it with Ocasio-Cortez, you know, she had such a massive ground game. And when you look at, obviously, the post-avail about the Joe Crowley campaign, they relied on the older system, the Queen's machine, to get it done.
Right.
Quite frankly, you know, because of the whole redistricting, including the Bronx, and this was the first time that he had really saw a significant challenge in his 18 years in Congress, this was not surprising if you actually heard what was going on the ground.
But what happened, which is so interesting, is that they were able to mobilize. They were able to get people out into the street. The very people I was just talking about who don't usually go out and vote.
Well, it goes back to Joe's comment on the kitchen table issues, because Ocasio-Cortez focused exactly on those issues. Why are we, as New Yorkers, not getting opportunities to improve our lives? Why are we not being represented? Why is only the elite benefiting? And she spoke to specific pocketbook issues that people had worried about for a long time. And so she was a good organizer. She connected with people on those issues. And she spoke to specifically the questions that we should consider nationwide.
Well, yeah. But you know that you're a brilliant political scientist who studies things like identity politics, right?
Yes.
This was a classic election that went around identity politics. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the demographic of the district had changed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, in the old days, the word was middle class and older white people came out and they voted. And everybody else, the heck with them. They're not voting. Therefore, you don't have to pay any attention to them. So, Vera, I would ask you whether or not we can look forward to groups who make up a majority, and that's what happened here, of an area all of a sudden coming alive and voting there, you know, in their own identity. And I think that's the key here.
Well, I don't know that it necessarily was just identity. It was about social justice questions. What about our income? What about the affordability of our housing? What about improving our schools? And I think it seems to overlap at the moment, but really, in essence, I think it is about financial questions, economic questions, and opportunities for children, which is a much broader question than just, you know, what you focused on, identity politics. This may be a phase of it, but I think we're going to see that direction much more identified.
Well, we don't agree.
And then the other part of it, too, obviously, Joe Crowley was number four in the House Democratic leadership, and he was a kid. He was 56 compared to the top three. So once you knock him out of contention, then again, it goes back to the same question. Who do Democrats have to lead them to the next generation?
Yeah. And that's the problem. Guitar.
Since you haven't discussed it yet, how do you assess the big district, the FASO district?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's an interesting and very, very difficult question. You have a brilliant guy, went to Harvard, Rhodes Scholar, you name it, also did some hip-hop, and somebody wrote a letter and said, why did you have to mention that he did hip-hop, you know, on the radio? I said, well, because he did, because that tells you a little bit about, you know, who the guy is. Now I think if I'm John Faso, I'm probably thinking of all of the candidates, this may have been the best candidate for me to oppose because he's the most unlike me, don't you think?
Yeah, but to a degree. But what you also saw, though, later in primary evening, but also on Wednesday, you saw a number of Delgado's opponents actually endorse him and say, we need to be unified if we're going to take. Right.
And some may think he's going to lose and that they get the next shot, all that, so you never know.
I tell you, something struck me immediately is that in his quote-unquote congratulations statement, Faso congratulated Delgado and then immediately
beat
went into this carpetbagging business.
Immediate.
Right.
Yeah. And I thought that was such bad form.
Well, it's distasteful, this and the congratulations.
But apparently it works.
Well, here's what I think.
In that district, it has.
I do not believe, if that's the issue that they're going to try to pin on Delgado, that is not going to work. People who want to see Faso out of here don't care if Delgado or anybody else moved into that district yesterday. This is the guy. He was impressive. A lot of people like his progressive politics. There may be other reasons that he won't win this election. I wonder in parts of the election if the fact that he's black is going to hurt him. But that said, the other thing is, I my memory of my working days, it gets harder and harder. But Faso was the chairman of the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee in New York State.
As well as the minority leader of the New York State Assembly.
And he fashioned a campaign in that district, in an assembly district in Ulster County, that did something that I never thought could happen, which was he made the incumbent Democrat a sympathetic figure. And this guy is not a sympathetic figure. Mm-hmm. They ran the dirtiest, nastiest campaign for their young Republican candidate. He made the mistake of letting them take over their campaign. He was a young man, and he perhaps didn't know better. He's the son of a well-known, respected moderate Republican in Ulster County. And he lost. And my point being, all of these races are going to be dirty and nasty. Yeah. And this, keep your eye on this one. This is going to be the grandfather.
By the way, I couldn't agree with you more. And I do think, though, there are the things you take on subliminally, and then there are the things you take on, you know, where you say he's a carpetbagger. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. But, you know, there are some real differences in these two guys. And I think that...
Philosophical.
Well, philosophical identity-wise.
Yeah.
I think what happens is you allow somebody else to carry your mail for you rather than you're doing the disgusting stuff.
But what's interesting, too, is that you see this visceral hate for John Fester. You didn't see any of this for Chris Gibson when he had the seat just a few years ago.
Well, Gibson was, I believe, a moderate conservative, if that's a, you don't usually hear those terms connected. But he
was then. You know, then there was a different time.
People were afraid of Gibson came in, and he allayed... generally allayed the fears of the people in the district. Fasso, and Fasso is connected to Trump.
And on top of that, if you look at, you know, who faced Gibson and who had faced Fasso, you know, both basically the NRCC continues to use this carpetbagging line, which has worked for them in every single election over the last 8 years.
Sure.
I will be shocked if Fasso wins because Delgado is a carpetbagger. He may win for other reasons, but I don't believe that.
No, you'll never know.
Well, you don't know unless it's you get from exit polls, but
you'll never know. And a lot of people lie to their pollsters, and we've been seeing a lot of that lately.
I mean, right. We can't rely on pollsters.
I mean, that brings to mind that Crowley thing. How could they possibly have had an accurate polling if he was up in a district where there was 30,000 votes? He was 35% ahead, and he lost by, 8 points?
I'm about to tell you the answer to that one. If you are a pollster, you take a look at who turned out in the previous elections. If you found out that the same old, you know, white guys basically turned out in a district, and that people of color, Hispanics, people who are black, didn't turn out, that's how you wait
who's going to vote.
And those people showed up.
Right.
And then you look again. That's exactly right. So you have these people who are called primes and super primes who, again, they have the history of voting. And so if they're not included in the poll, then that would be the result.
Yeah, you're right, Joe, as always.
We have a minute.
Oh, here's another one. Hello, all. This is an excellent discussion. I see a headline article this morning citing a survey in which 1/3 of Americans report they believe a civil war may be coming within the next 5 years. It seems insane. And yet the ideological divide becomes wider and wider, and it almost seems possible. What do you think? I don't think so.
Carl Bernstein has been saying for quite some time that the country is in a cold civil war.
And David said, this is not normal. Good morning, panel. Those of you who would criticize the owner of the Red Hen and Maxine Waters for daring to say people should push back against the white nationalists currently destroying our country are forgetting one thing. We are living in extraordinary times. Maintaining the status quo through some mistaken idea of civility sends the message that everything is normal. It is not, and let's make that absolutely clear. And that's from David from way up there in Oneonta.
Okay.
Are we still reading?
All right, one more.
Yep.
Okay. I know he said one more last time, but you have 12 seconds.
Peter says, panel, as a manager of a restaurant, I could never ask my beautiful queer immigrant staff to serve someone who demonstrates a willingness to negotiate on their basic humanity or their mouthpiece. And that's from Peter in New Marlborough.
Yes. Stick with that.
Yeah. All right. We'll end there. My thanks to Joe Bonilla, Ira Fussfeld, Vera Akarios-Kelly. Alan, thank you. And we will be back right after this.